From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The movie One Night in Miami imagines the conversations among four iconic black men in 1964. Cassius Clay, Sam Cooke, Jim Brown, and Malcolm X on the night of Clay's upset win over Sonny Liston. Today we feature our archive interviews about three of those men. We hear from Peter Guralnick, who wrote a biography of Sam Cooke, with Jonathan Eig, who spent 4 years researching and writing a biography of Muhammad Ali, previously known as Cassius Clay, and with Alex Haley, who was chosen by Malcolm X to write his now famous autobiography. That was before Haley wrote his seminal book, Roots. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new biopic about Billie Holiday on Hulu. The film One Night in Miami is an imagined account of the evening in 1964 in which Sam Cooke, Jim Brown, Malcolm X, and Cassius Clay have gathered to celebrate Clay's victory over Sonny Liston to become the world heavyweight boxing champion. The four were friends and did spend that evening together, but their conversations are fictional. In the film, there's a contentious exchange between Malcolm X and Sam Cooke, as Malcolm castigates Cooke for not singing songs that directly promote black power. When Cooke announces he's preparing for his show at the Copacabana, where black audiences have not been welcome in the past, Malcolm calls him out. Leslie Odom Jr. plays Sam Cooke. Kingsley Ben-Adir plays Malcolm.
What kind of message are you sending, though, by doing one show for white folks and a completely different show for black folks, Sam? Listen to me. You're performing in places where the only black people not on stage are the ones serving the food.
Don't you think I know that? Can't tell you how many times I wanted to reach out and punch somebody.
Then strike with the weapon that you have, man, your voice. Black people, we standing up. Mm-hmm. We speaking out. Sam, you have possibly one of the most effective, beautiful outlets of us all. You're not using it to help the cause, brother.
Hell, I'm not. I got the masters to my songs. I started a label. I'm producing tons of black artists. Don't you think my determining my creative and business destiny is every bit as inspiring to people as you standing up on a podium trying to piss them off?
One Night in Miami has been nominated for 2 Golden Globe Awards, one for Regina King, who directed the film, and the other for Leslie Odom Jr., who co-starred as Sam Cooke. On today's Fresh Air, we're going to listen back to 3 Fresh Air interviews about figures depicted in the film. Jonathan Eig is the author of a noted biography of Muhammad Ali, who was known as Cassius Clay before he joined the Nation of Islam. And also from our archives, an interview with Alex Haley, who co-authored the autobiography of Malcolm X. We'll begin by hearing about singer, songwriter, and civil rights activist Sam Cooke. Cooke was a major pop star with crossover appeal, best known for his hits from the 50s and 60s, including You Send Me, Wonderful World, and Chain Gang. Long before it was common, he was producing his own records and started his own record label. And beginning in the late 1950s, he refused to perform before segregated audiences. Before he sang soul music, Cooke sang gospel. When he crossed over, his success encouraged other gospel singers to try secular music as well, including Aretha Franklin. In 2005, Terry interviewed Peter Guralnick, whose biography of Sam Cooke is titled Dream Boogie. They started with one of Cooke's biggest hits.
Darling, you send me. I know you send me. Darling, you send me. Honest you do, honest you do, honest you do. Lasted so long. Now I find myself wanting to marry you and take you home. Whoa, whoa.
Peter Guralnick, welcome back to Fresh Air. This is the song that Sam Cooke crossed over with from gospel to pop. What did it mean to Cooke to cross over and to have, you know, a number one song on the pop charts?
For it meant tremendous fear and tremendous relief. I mean, the greatest barrier to Sam Cooke crossing over was not so much a religious concern. He never left the church. He never left gospel music. He continued to sing gospel music until the day he died and to write gospel songs. So it really wasn't a matter of challenging his faith. And he had been brought up by his father to look for the opportunity. I mean, his father was a member of a striving generation, part of the Great Migration to Chicago, and someone who really taught his children to get ahead, that you didn't, whether you made your living by singing or shining shoes, that had nothing to do with your dedication to God. Sam's father, incidentally, was a minister, the Reverend Charles Cooke, in the Church of Christ Holiness. But for Sam, the great fear was that he wouldn't succeed. He knew what he had in gospel music. He had come up against an economic wall. He had come up against a wall in terms of the success that he could see for himself, and he didn't want to stop with that wall. He, from Sam's point of view, there was no end to his ambition. But at the same time, there was that kind of fear that any of us might feel, that what if I do this and I don't succeed? And the great fear was that if he didn't succeed, if he failed in pop music, that he would never be able to go back to gospel. He would never be accepted again.
Peter, how do you think Sam Cooke's gospel singing compared to his pop singing?
I think it compared, in some ways it compared very directly, in other ways it contrasted. I think the comparison is that Sam learned, he was inclined very early on, and he learned very early on that his strength, his mark, was really in lowering the volume. And that was the basis for Sam's gospel style, was this kind of crooning style. It was a seductive style. That was what he brought to pop music. That's what I think is so extraordinary about his transition to pop music, and was what both Bumps Blackwell, his producer, and what J.W. Alexander, and what this DJ in Newark who managed Roy Hamilton, Bill Cooke, all saw in him. They saw the potential for a teenage singing idol. J.W. Alexander felt that Sam was the first black performer, rhythm and blues performer, who had the potential to really be a matinee idol for teenagers, black and white, and for whom the category didn't have to exist. This depended to some extent on Sam's looks, because he was an extraordinarily good-looking man. But it also depended on the manner of his singing, which was not challenging, was not threatening, and didn't require a tremendous adjustment on the part of a white audience to what he was presenting.
Another way in which Sam Cooke was groundbreaking is that he co-founded and co-owned a record label that he started with his friend and business partner, J.W. Alexander. Why did he want that?
It really stemmed from an innate sense of black pride and self-determination, which was something. He was a student of black history at a time when the term didn't exist. He was someone who had been brought up by his father to believe that you should respect yourself most of all, never allow anyone to disrespect you, but respect yourself most of all. He realized very early on the same thing that many performers, both black and white, recognized, which is that he did not own the fruits of his own labor, that other people were making money off of his creative endeavor, and that, in fact, particularly with respect to songwriting, that this was really where the money was and where the money still is today in the music business, is both in writing and publishing songs.
One of Sam Cooke's greatest records was released on an album very late in his life, and it was released posthumously as a single. And the song is "A Change Is Gonna Come." This is a song that he wrote. And before we actually hear it, what inspired this song, and what was the change of direction it represented in his music?
What inspired the song, "A Change Is Gonna Come," was really everything that was going on in this country, in Sam's consciousness at that time, with respect to the racial situation, with respect to the civil rights movement, with respect to the sit-ins. Specifically, Sam was inspired, he was on tour in North Carolina in the spring of 1963, and he and J.W. Alexander spoke with the student sit-ins and spoke quite extensively, and that was something which was very memorable for him. Within a couple of months of that, J.W. Alexander gave him the Bob Dylan album that had Blowing in the Wind on it, and Sam responded extremely, very directly to that song, and told J.W. what a great song it was, but it should have been written by a black man. It shouldn't, you know, it wasn't that he had, he was very admiring of Bob Dylan, as he was of the Rolling Stones, of the Animals. I mean, his ears were wide open, and he heard new sounds, and he talked to Bobby Womack quite a bit about the way in which someone like Dylan put a song across. Bobby Womack said, "That's terrible, that guy can't sing." And Bobby said, "Listen to the words, listen to the way he puts the songs across, listen to the credibility he has, listen to the way in which an audience will respond to it." He said, "That's the future." In any case, Sam, Blowing in the Wind was unquestionably influential. I think there's no doubt that the Birmingham demonstrations and then the in the spring of 63 and then the March on Washington meant an enormous amount to him. And right in the wake of that, Sam had his own, well, he had many moments. You couldn't escape the moments all through your, no African-American could escape an awareness of the racial situation every minute of every day. But Sam's experience in Shreveport, when he got turned away from the motel and refused to back down, was an enormously traumatic event, just as it had been in 1949 when in Memphis he got picked up by the police for going into a whites-only park, and he got cuffed around by them and spoke of it to the end of his life. So that humiliation, that that indignation, he wrote "A Change Is Going to Come," I would say, within a month or so. What scared Sam the most about the song was that it came to him almost unannounced. It came to him in a dream. And this is what he told everybody. He played the song for his wife Barbara, for J.W. Alexander, for Bobby Womack, for Leroy Kroom from the Soul Stirrers, and told them all essentially the same thing, which was that the song had just come to him. It had come to him unannounced. Unlike other songs which he worked on, this song simply presented itself in its complete form, and it scared him. He didn't know where it was coming from, and he and Bobby Womack talked about it, and his feeling was it felt like death. And I can't really interpret what that means. I mean, I don't know whether it was the sense that he was not in control of what he was saying. It's such a, it's a beautifully written, it's a beautifully crafted song, both the melody and the lyrics. And it's typical of Sam in the sense that rather than being yoked to a specific event, it starts from a generality, from a saying that can apply, "A Change Is Going to Come," that can apply to almost anything. And it's the reason, I think, that the song has continued to have currency all these years.
Do you think that if Sam Cooke had lived, that "A Change Is Going to Come" would have been the start of a new direction for him, a new, more socially engaged type of song?
You know, I think he really intended to go in every direction at once. And I think one of those directions would have been, you know, a more socially conscious one. And the fact that in that same year, in 1964, he started the first of what were intended to be a series of soul stations. He called the Soul Station Number 1, which were kind of neighborhood storefront locations which would offer talented but sort of disaffected black youth the opportunity to come in, to try out, to rehearse, along with the idea of doing some things that were more socially conscious. He had committed to doing a concert, civil rights, a concert for Dr. Martin Luther King. But at the same time, he also intended, he had just signed a movie contract. He intended to go to Las Vegas. All of these things, in a sense, for most people, would cancel each other out. And you would tend to think, well, if he goes in that direction, he can't possibly go in this other direction. That means he won't do this thing. But in Sam's mind, I think he believed he could do it all. He could appeal to everyone across the board. And he was not inclined to limit himself in any way.
Peter Gorelnik, thank you so much for talking with us about Sam Cooke.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh,
He was one of the most consequential architects of the civil rights movement. But you may never have heard of him.
For our Black History Month special series, Bayard Rustin, who made nonviolence part of the fight for civil rights and organized the March on Washington.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
We're listening to interviews from our archives about three of the four men depicted in the film One Night in Miami. It's an imagined account of the evening in 1964 in which Sam Cooke, Malcolm X, Jim Brown, and Muhammad Ali, then known as Cassius Clay, gathered to celebrate his first win over Sonny Liston. Next, we'll hear parts of my 2017 interview with Jonathan Eig about parts of his biography of Muhammad Ali called Ali, A Life, in which he writes about Ali's association with the Nation of Islam. Talk a bit about his perceptions of race and how, you know, how the Nation of Islam appealed to him.
Well, Ali was the same age as Emmett Till, and everybody knew what had happened to Emmett Till for speaking back, giving sass to a white woman. He was, you know, killed brutally, and the killers got away with it. And Ali's father was a race man. He was a Garveyite who believed that black people were never going to get a fair deal in this country. They'd just have to go back to Africa if they were ever going to have a fair shake. And Ali grew up steeped in that kind of thinking and talking. I found the letter that he wrote when he first explained why he became a Muslim, why he got interested in the Nation of Islam. And it wasn't really about the religion. It was about the cultural issues. He bought into this. He loved this idea that that black people could take responsibility for their own lives. And I think this, for somebody who is boxing, who is having the opportunity to build his own life, to through discipline, through training, hard work, and getting the ability to be treated as an equal, at least in the boxing ring, the Nation of Islam really struck a chord with him.
The leader, of course, was Elijah Muhammad, but a rising star within the Nation of Islam was Malcolm X, who, you know, wrote that famous autobiography, later had a falling out with the leadership of the Nation of Islam and was murdered. He became close to Ali. What was their relationship like?
Ali and Malcolm X were like little brother and big brother. Malcolm was this very charismatic, brilliant man who, you know, also come from humble beginnings and taught himself and very much lived the ethos of the Nation of Islam when it came to self-improvement. And he was also a big boxing fan, so he loved hanging around Ali. Ali was just this unbelievable personality. Everybody just loved being in his presence. One of his first girlfriends told me that it was impossible not to have fun. It was impossible to be in a bad mood when you were in the room with Ali. So he and Malcolm really hit it off, and I think Malcolm became a real mentor to him and taught him that the philosophy that Elijah Muhammad was teaching was a really powerful one, and that Ali could go into the ring believing that he had Allah on his side, that he had a calling, that he was doing something much bigger than boxing here, that he had an opportunity to really change the world if he was successful.
So in 1964, as this huge showdown approaches, Sonny Liston, the heavyweight champion, huge favorite in the fight, and Cassius Clay promising to knock him out, Clay had become closer to the Nation of Islam. How well known was this, and how did it affect the promotion of the fight?
There were rumors all over the place by the time of the fight that Ali was about to join this group that white Americans perceived as a terrorist organization, and the FBI was already keeping tabs on him. The FBI was already using Angelo Dundee, Ali's trainer, as an informant to find out who was coming around. So Ali wasn't talking about it. They asked him not to talk about it. They asked Malcolm X to leave Miami, the promoters of the fight, because they felt like it was bad for business, that it was hurting ticket sales, that nobody really knew who to root for anymore, because Sonny Liston is this ogre, and now Ali, the fresh young face, he might be more hated than Sonny Liston because of his association with the Nation of Islam and his bad sportsmanship and his constant yapping. So they kept it pretty quiet, or tried to anyway, at least until the fight could get over with.
Muhammad Ali faces a tough decision because his friend Malcolm X splits with Elijah Muhammad, who is the leader of the Nation of Islam. What did Muhammad Ali do in this circumstance?
You know, it's an important crossroads in Ali's life, but it was not a difficult decision for him. In fact, because he was so fiercely loyal to Elijah Muhammad that he would do anything for the messenger, as he called him. And when Elijah Muhammad broke with Malcolm X, Malcolm X had been in a long-running feud with Elijah Muhammad. He'd been suspended from the Nation of Islam. He had accused Elijah Muhammad of having all these affairs with his secretaries and impregnating them. And there were some who felt like Elijah Muhammad had suggested that it would be okay if Malcolm X were assassinated. That, but Ali did not struggle with this decision at all, and he was actually quite cold toward Malcolm and said that he thought Malcolm deserved to die before the assassination. So at one point, Malcolm's wife approached Ali and said, "Please help me do something. There have been attempts on Malcolm's life already." And Ali brushed her off.
So Muhammad Ali has a second fight with Sonny Liston, takes him out in one round. There's controversy about it. But he's then on top of the world. I mean, he is the heavyweight champion and a national celebrity. And he runs into a problem with his draft status. I mean, the Vietnam War was beginning to heat up. What happens to Ali with the draft board?
Ali is on top of the world. He's the heavyweight champ. He's making money very quickly. He's buying all the cars he wants, and life is looking good. You know, he's still wildly unpopular as a result of his association with the Nation of Islam. Reporters are refusing to call him Muhammad Ali. They almost all still refer to him as Cassius Clay, as if he had no choice in his name. They were going to call him what they wanted to call him. And then he gets even more unpopular when he says he doesn't want to serve if he's drafted in Vietnam. First, he says he just doesn't want to go. And it's really interesting. I found a tape of Ali watching himself on TV. There's this great reporter named Jack Olson from Sports Illustrated who just kept the tape recorder running for hours and hours. And his tapes are archived now. And you can listen to Ali as he's watching himself on TV. And his initial comments are, "I just don't want to go. You know, send some other athletes over there. Send some football players. I'm making a lot of money right now, and the government's taking a lot of that money in taxes, and they can use my taxes to buy all the bomber jets they want and all the tanks they want, and they can go over there and kill all the Vietnamese they want. Just don't send me. I don't want to go." And then he starts to evolve on that position, and he says, "Well, I'm opposed to this because I'm treated like a second-class citizen in this country. Black people, why should we go fight for our country when we're treated like second-class citizens? And why should we go over there and kill some dark-skinned Asians when dark-skinned people here are suffering? And black people are dying in these hugely disproportionate numbers in the war. Why should I be a part of that?" So now he's beginning to make it a political argument. And then after a little more time goes by and he speaks to Elijah Muhammad about this, then he begins to say, "Well, it's also a religious issue, that I'm a conscientious objector because my faith says that we don't fight in wars, in earthly wars." So it's really interesting to see his position evolve, but no matter how it evolves, he just becomes more and more unpopular, more hated. I think he may be the most hated man in America at this point.
And it really it froze his career, right? I mean, his title was stripped. He was state boxing councils refused to let him compete. He was essentially on ice, right?
That's right. And that's another way in which he was treated differently. There's nothing that says that a convicted felon cannot box. There are plenty of convicted felons in the boxing ring. Most states allow them to box. So he should have been allowed to box while his case was on appeal. And he was not. He was denied a license, and he was stripped of his heavyweight crown. He gave up 3.5 years of his prime career when he was at his peak as an athlete and his peak as a money earner, because he was a political symbol, I think.
You know, you're right that in 1965 he was probably the most hated man in America, or at least in white America. And then by the 70s, it all began to change. Why?
It's fascinating to see this happen. And, you know, we forget sometimes that Ali was so deeply hated because the Ali of the 70s is very different. When he comes back from his exile, first of all, the war is wildly unpopular. When he began his protest, there was still very strong support for the war in Vietnam. But by 1971, people can say, "Well, Ali was right. That war has been a disaster. No wonder he didn't want to fight over there." He also has suffered. He's given up 3.5 years of his career and millions of dollars. And then he comes back to the ring and he fights Joe Frazier and he gets whooped. Frazier knocks him on his butt with this vicious left hook. Ali gets up. He keeps fighting. This is one of the greatest and most vicious fights in boxing history. And Ali loses, but he stays on his feet. He survives this thing. And I think then you begin to see him as a martyr, as a hero, as somebody who's gets knocked down and keeps coming back. And he's got to start earning his way back toward another shot at the heavyweight championship. And this is when you begin to see the public attitude changing. There's a you can't deny some of your admiration for this guy's toughness.
Jonathan Eig's biography of Muhammad Ali is Ali, a Life. After a short break, we'll hear part of Terry's interview with Alex Haley, co-author of the autobiography of Malcolm X. This is Fresh Air.
When the survivors of a mass shooting at a newspaper went back to work, everything was different, even email.
What if someone's sending us more death threats? Or what if somebody sends me a death threat and I don't see it, and then somebody comes and kills all my friends and it's my fault because I didn't read the email?
That's this week on the Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded.
This is Fresh Air. Today we're listening to past interviews about three of the four men portrayed in the new film One Night in Miami, an account of the evening in 1964 in which Sam Cooke, Malcolm X, Jim Brown, and Cassius Clay gathered to celebrate his first win over Sonny Liston. Next, we'll hear part of Terry's interview with Alex Haley, co-author of the autobiography of Malcolm X. Haley's book, Roots, which traced his family back six generations to West Africa, won the Pulitzer Prize and was also the subject of a popular TV series in 1977. Haley grew up in a small town in Tennessee and spent 20 years in the Coast Guard before he began writing. In the early 60s, Haley wrote a magazine article about Malcolm X. Later, when a publisher approached Malcolm X about writing his autobiography, he turned to Haley to write the book. Haley spent a year interviewing him for his autobiography. Malcolm X was murdered before the book was published in 1965. Terry spoke with Alex Haley in 1985. She asked him if the differences in politics and background between him and Malcolm X ever got in the way.
Our backgrounds were very different. You know, I was and I am a Methodist, and I'm from Henning, Tennessee, and Malcolm was a Muslim, and he was from a variety of places. And his background had included what is colloquially called life in the streets and things like that. And I just simply hadn't been exposed to that. So in terms of things like, you know, that Malcolm had experienced, I was as square as a block. But I was a grown man, I was reasonably experienced, and I was hopefully a writer.
Did he get impatient with you?
About what?
About being different from him, about being, quote, square, and not being exposed to.
It would sometimes amuse him when I didn't know this, that, or the other. The only time I ever saw Malcolm angry, really angry, and that was a fearsome sight to see because he was generally very contained. He might be furious, but you'd never know it oftentimes. We were in his car once up in Harlem, and at this time, things had begun to get pretty taut around him and his life. He was not a person, he used to say himself, upon whom anybody would do well to write an insurance policy. And so when you rode with him as his passenger, you tended to be a little light in the seat, you know. And then we were driving along, and he was doing not all that rapidly, but all of a sudden he hit the brake, and the car just jolted to a stop. And before I know anything, Malcolm has flung open his door, and he's out of the car. And by the time I registered what was happening, I didn't know what on earth was the provocation for this. I didn't know if somebody was trying to shoot him or shoot us or what. But no, it wasn't that at all. He sprang out, and there were three young men bent over on their knees shooting craps up against the door. And it happened that it didn't register to me, but he knew it. That was the door of the County Cullen Library in Harlem, within which was the Schomburg Collection, the greatest extant collection about material about black people. And Malcolm was over these people like, I think I wrote, like an avenging angel. He was furious. And he was just grating out something like, said, inside these doors is the greatest collection in existence on black people, and other people in there studying about you and your people, and the best you can do is sit out here and shoot craps up against the door. And it has to be said for him that such was his personality, such was his impact, that these three young men, I'd say they were, you know, early 20s or something like that, and street guys, I would guess, they might have, I hate to think what they might have done to somebody else who dared come up on them like that. But once they recognized it was Malcolm, they almost skulked away. How furious he got about the fact that these young men were not seizing an opportunity better to educate themselves about their own people, or about whatever. He used to often say he wished he could start all over academically. And he used to say every night they'd have to put me out of the library when they had to close it. You know.
You spent a year interviewing him. Was he hard to interview?
You asked the perfect thing, not knowing you asked it, to get me to tell you the thing I wanted to tell you to begin with, about when I told you Malcolm got irritated at me. After the assignment had come to write a book about himself, we made agreement, he and I, he would come down to my little place. I had a place at the time in Greenwich Village at 92 Grove Street in the basement. And he faithfully began to come down about three nights a week. He'd get there 9:30 or something after his busy, busy day. And I would interview him. At least that was the intent. Malcolm was not somebody you interviewed. You tended to listen for 2 hours as he would talk. And it went on, and he didn't talk about himself. All he would talk about was Mr. Muhammad, his leader, and about the Nation of Islam, his organization. And by the time he'd done that for about a month, I began to say to him, Mr. Malcolm, I know both, fine, but this book is to be about you, and we have to know something about you. And he began to get peeved and then irritated. And finally, we were in the second month, by which time I had begun to get also peeved in another direction, and I had begun to think that I really, in fairness, had to go to the publisher and say, I'm not being able to get through to him, and you may have to get somebody else to write or whatever you want to do, and that's only fair. Sometimes that happens, just chemistry. And then this night, it was cold. The snow was knee-deep in New York. I don't know what had happened to Malcolm that day, and I'm uptight internally, and he's uptight. He came down that night, and he was just absolutely, again, furious. I don't know what had happened to him that day. He stalked the floor. And I remember that I knew it's like a desperate try. I've got to get this man to talk about himself. And so once again, it was maybe about 11 o'clock at night, I tried. I said, Mr. Malcolm, we've got to have something about you. And he snatched his coat up, glared at me, and started out. I remember he snatched the door open, and I remember seeing how the snow had drifted up over the door jamb. You know how to do that. And why I said to him what I said, I will never know. I didn't think it. It was one of those situations, Terry, where you hear yourself saying something. You don't know where the words come. I don't know. I wouldn't have consciously asked a Malcolm X that. But I heard myself say to him, very quietly, Mr. Malcolm, could you tell me something about your mother? And I remember looking at him as almost as if he were a marionette on a string. He just kind of stopped. And I remember he closed the door, and he turned around that I can remember. I don't remember him looking directly at me, but he began to walk, and he walked more slowly than before. And I guess he made a round of the room. Before then he spoke, and his voice was kind of higher register than he normally spoke. And he said, it's funny you should ask me that. And then he walked a little more. And then he said, I remember how she was always bent over the stove, trying to stretch what little we had. And then he walked some more, and he said, and I remember the kind of dresses she wore. They were faded and gray. And that man, I tell you, Terry, he walked that floor from then, about 11:30 maybe, until the day broke. And out of him that night, that morning, spilled, tumbled. I don't think I wouldn't have asked a question. All I'm doing is taking notes as hard as I can. Out of him spilled and tumbled the essence of what is now in the first chapter of the autobiography of Malcolm X, titled appropriately, Nightmare, the story of the little boy who was about 7, in the household with his mother, with, I believe, there were a total of 7 children, and the mother was trying the best she could to hold them together, to feed them, to care for them, to just generally be the family elder for them, with the father, the minister, recently murdered, thrown under a streetcar, you know. And that was the most dramatic moment I remember. And from that point, he never hesitated to talk about any aspect of his life once that was opened.
How do you think it affected him to, in a structured way, go through his the whole past that he had that he could remember, you know, to give it to you for your book? Because it's like being in therapy to go through your past in such detail. I mean, it might,
I think it probably was for him, you know. I know one thing, the thing I just now was telling you about, a few weeks after that, he told me he'd be away, and he went away for a while. I didn't ask him where. You didn't ask him where he was going. And when he came back, he was smiles, unusually so. And then he told me that he had been to Michigan, where he had gotten together with his brother, Philbert. And his brother was a minister in the Nation of Islam. And they had gone together to the institution where their mother had been for quite a long time. I don't know, was it 10, 15 years? And they had taken the first steps to have their mother released into the custody. She would be in the home of the brother, Philbert. And Malcolm was beaming. And I remember he said that he had kept locked up in himself the memory of what he told me that night, because he just didn't want to deal with it, didn't want to face it, didn't want to think about it. But that once he had opened it, then he knew he had to go back and see his mother and help his mother and so forth. And I looked back at the incident, and I could not be more certain about the fact that I had no idea when I asked him that question that it would evoke such a response. And I didn't even realize that I was asking the question, not in a conscious way. Many things, now and then, some things will happen in writing that kind of get you in a, you don't know where it came from, and you don't question it. It just happened.
Terry Gross speaking with Alex Haley in 1985. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new Billie Holiday biopic on Hulu. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting The Pulse, a podcast that takes you on adventures into unexpected corners of health and science. Plastic in the guts of deep sea creatures, crying after anesthesia, building your own internet. Each episode is full of fascinating stories and big ideas. The Pulse, available where you get your podcasts or at WHYY.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org.
This is Fresh Air.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Billie Holiday in 1956, revisiting her signature song Strange Fruit, whose lyrics depict a lynching. The song is central to Hulu's new biopic, The United States versus Billie Holiday. Our jazz critic and jazz film follower, Kevin Whitehead, has this review.
The movies have not been kind to Billie Holiday. In the 1935 Duke Ellington short, Symphony in Black, Holiday at age 19 played a spurned woman, bounced to the studio floor by her unfaithful man in take after painful take. In the 1947 feature New Orleans, she played a white opera singer's housemaid, though in both those films she got to sing too. In the 1972 biopic, Lady Sings the Blues, she was played by Diana Ross, who looked and sounded nothing like her. Worse, the story turned the last of her terrible husbands, Lewis McKay, played by Billy Dee Williams, into a saintly figure who's always there for her. Now comes Hulu's The United States versus Billie Holiday, directed by Lee Daniels from a script by playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks. The best thing about it by far is singer and screen newcomer Andra Day in the lead. She carries the movie with conviction and looks kind of like the real Holiday with those gardenias in her hair. She also catches Billy's later singing voice well. Andra Day likewise replicates the croaky way Holiday spoke in her last years in the late 1950s. Never mind that she talks that way through the whole picture, as in this scene set in 1947.
I cut strange fruit.
No, Joe, I want to sing the damn song, all right? The club advertises it. People pay good money to come here and hear me sing it.
I've told you 100 times, people in high places don't want you singing that song.
And I've asked you over 100 times, what people, Joe? What you looking at him for? I'm no one pays you.
The government.
In some ways, the United States versus Billie Holiday offers a corrective to Lady Sings the Blues. Louis McKay, played by Rob Morgan, is no angel in this picture. He's one in a line of her abusive mates. The film is frank about appalling ways she was treated by her men and by law enforcement, right down to her being arrested for heroin possession while lying on her hospital deathbed in 1959. In the United States versus Billie Holiday, federal agents wage a vigorous campaign for years to make her stop singing Strange Fruit, that scathing portrait of lynching as a Southern tradition. There's more anecdotal than hard evidence of any such campaign. The film's big bad is federal anti-drug czar Harry Anslinger, played by Garrett Hedlund in a grim one-note performance. His Anslinger is even worse than the real one, who was happy to crack down on drug-using jazz musicians, black ones in particular, a surefire way to make headlines. The real Anslinger did take an interest in Holiday's case, but in the film, her drug busts are just leverage to make her stop singing that song. Evidently shirking his duties in Washington, movie Anslinger obsessively turns up at Holiday's New York gigs to glare at her from the audience as if he hates music in general. Even his wife is a Holiday fan. Later, he harasses her in the hospital as she's dying. In the film's 1940s, Anslinger instructs African-American narcotics agent Jimmy Fletcher, played by Moonlight's Trevante Rhodes, to cozy up to her.
Pardon me for asking, but why is that song so important to us?
Hoover says it's un-American. You've heard those lyrics. They provoke people in the wrong way.
There was a real Jimmy Fletcher, and he and Holiday came to be on friendly terms despite their adversarial relationship. In the movie, Jimmy falls in love with her hard and she with him, and they have a hot, long-lasting affair. It's pure poppycock, but Andra Day and Trevante Rhodes have good sexual chemistry on screen, bringing some charm and romance to a mostly dreary narrative. In this scene, they're just getting to know each other before Billy finds out he's a narc.
Why don't you ever sing Strange Fruit?
Strange Fruit. I gotta be pretty high to sing that one.
Never heard you sing it.
It's a song about important things, you know. Things that are going on in the country. I don't think people know I care about those things. Most of my other songs are just about love.
Well, love is important too, right?
Later, after he's exposed, Jimmy shoots heroin with her one time, which somehow makes him flashback to her unhappy childhood, a narcotic mind meld. Holiday once said she'd been asked to stop singing Strange Fruit during a week-long stand at Philadelphia's Earle Theater in 1947, just before the drug bust that sent her to prison for a year. In the movie, a Fed orders local cops to shut down her Philly show the second it starts, when she defiantly opens with that song.
Silent trees.
Get her off that stage.
Yeah, that didn't happen. She completed her week in Philly without incident. At worst, the United States versus Billie Holiday is as heedless of the facts as Lady Sings the Blues was, even restaging that movie's fictitious episode where Billie comes on the scene of a lynching down south, as if she needed to see it to truly sing it. As in Lady Sings the Blues, she plays Carnegie Hall in 1948 with a big band and strings, not a quartet as in real life. And like the Diana Ross movie, this one invents a good and loving man who faithfully stands by her. To be fair, biographical movies are entertainments, not history lessons. This is hardly the first biopic to invent stuff when the real story is dramatic enough. Made-up incidents can illustrate some higher truth about the power of a protest song or a singer's personal magnetism. But having Billie Lever Band stranded down south in the middle of a tour is a low blow. She respected her fellow musicians too much for that. Billie Holiday deserves better. A biopic that, say, shows how her voice changed over her quarter-century recording career from girlish to mature to brittle, reflecting all that heartache and hard living. Then we'd have something closer to the real Billie Holiday story.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the new book Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He reviewed The United States versus Billie Holiday, which premieres on Hulu today.
Who loves you? Ask yourself the question. Who loves you, sweetheart? And tell me who thinks of you a million times a day. And who's blue and lonely, honey, when you're away? Say, who needs you? Needs you every minute. Who fell for you from the start? Oh, who just longs for your caresses? You don't have to take three guesses. Who loves you, sweetheart?
On Monday's show, we speak with writer, performer, and magician Derek Del Gaudio. His new memoir recalls the days when he used his sleight of hand skills to cheat other players in a high-stakes private poker game. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.